for the flames came out too fast, too strong, and reached for him instead. "Stay back, outlaw," Smoke said, and the outlaw breathed fire, and the fire caught on Smoke's shirt and pants, and his shins too, and then the whole place went whoomp, boom, and beyond the flames, beyond the fire, he saw the outlaw staring at him, not burning, and Smoke howled as the fire caught the hair on his arms, the hair on his head, and his flesh smelled like rotting mice, and his bones blackened, and the flames scurried up his neck over his teeth across his paper-like tongue, down his ashen throat. But his eyes remained. His eyes were the last to go, and with them, Smoke saw Moxie through the blaze. The outlaw wasn't laughing, wasn't talking, wasn't anything, wasn't burning neither. Light.
"It's your own breathing," Hattie said.
She said it once, and she said it with such flat finality that a very young Carol never forgot it. Hattie had a way of talking like that when she wanted to. Her maternal face would become something of a static rendering, a face that neither frowned nor smiled. The truth, Carol came to understand it, as Hattie saw it. For years, the theory helped Carol. At 8 years old, hearing hoarse breathing inside the coma was enough to scare her silly. Was someone else in there with her? Did something live in Howltown?
"It's your own breathing."
No further explanation. No saying that Carol's body was slowed down, and if her heart beat at 1/60th of its normal rate, her breathing must change as well. Hattie must not have felt the need to explain her take.
"It's your own breathing," it was, and "it's your own breathing," it would be.
And yet John Bowie opened the door on this one, sitting across from Carol at Finn's, Harrow's Finer Seafood Saloon.
"At risk of sounding morbid, Carol, I'd at least consider that the coma could be a new place indeed. Have you considered that the coma is a plane of its own, a sort of non-religious purgatory? Perhaps the coma is between life and death, and the breathing you hear is not of this world."
As interesting as it was to discuss over dinner, these words were much more frightening when falling through the darkness, and sometimes Carol wished John had never spoken them. Like now, falling, still able to see the threshold she fell toward, still able to see the ripple roll across the garden toward her. And yet, what if John Bowie was right? What if the dead she heard breathing was dead John himself? Carol quickly, forcibly shoved these thoughts aside. Right now, she needed to do more than remember. She needed to do more than weigh the words of two incredible people she loved. She needed to act.
Roll over.
But how? She didn't know exactly. She'd never tried before. It seemed simple, in theory. If a wind was pressing against her, wouldn't a slight tilt to the right or left roll her over completely? Carol felt the electricity, the burning nerves of anxiety. She imagined herself rolling, unable to stop, spinning like John Bowie's toy top forever. And the steady, hoarse rhythm was getting louder.
"It's your own breathing."
This time it was Carol herself who said this. Of course it was her own breathing, and it made perfect sense. She was exerting herself, trying to rotate in the darkness, to feel the wind against her back for the first time ever in the coma. To fall up, perhaps, instead. She was working. It was something. Long ago, Hattie built a pulley contraption that rolled on wheels, followed Carol wherever she went. And the moment Carol fell, limp, it held her up in a standing position. Carol experienced one coma that way, standing. But there was no change within. Still, the sensation of falling. Still. So how to beat it? How to climb out? Roll over. She tried. Oh, how she tried. Such a natural movement. A tilt to either the right or the left. A simple inch would do. And yet, she couldn't. Heavier wheezing from the darkness, and Carol continued to tell herself it was her own. Her body was slowed down in the coma. It wasn't labored breathing she was hearing, but the grains of sand details of a regularly expelled exhalation amplified in Howltown. Inhale. Exhale.
all her own. Carol concentrated on the roll, rolling over. Once, as a young girl, Hattie helped Carol up the wood ladder of a metal slide. From the top, it looked like a 100-foot drop. Scared but exhilarated, Carol let go of Hattie's hand and came softly to the dirt at the slide's end. For this, Carol would call out for Hattie when the collapse came, when the free fall toward an impossible distance occurred. This slide with no wood ladder, no reality from which to discharge, not even the convincing cold metal of the slide beneath her. And most frightening of all, no lip, no dirt, no end. Yet the sensation was always toward the earth. Often Carol imagined the fall carried her into the earth, cracking its crust like a child's piñata, falling farther, deeper, never into a variety of muted light, but into the black, solid black, that dizzied her with misdirection, unease, confusion, lest a stone wall wait at the end there to greet her. Or here, a stone slab.
"If you know you're on your back in the workroom," Hattie once said, "then maybe you can plant your hands against it, whether it exists in the coma or not. Maybe you can still sit up without waking."
Now, trying so hard to focus on the slab, to roll, it felt to Carol as if every coma previous to this one constituted one continuous fall. The breathing. Closer now. In her mind's eye, Carol saw her friend John Bowie sitting up in his grave. Barefoot and unboxed, he raised his right hand, as if about to suggest something. Then Carol felt a hand upon her shoulder.
"John!"
But this was not the hand of John Bowie. This was no friend. The burn she felt from its sub-freezing temperature told her so. Carol tried to look, tried to see who had touched her, if such a thing was possible at all. But turning her head was just as impossible as turning her body, and so Carol only stared into the darkness through which she fell.
"Someone's in here with you. Someone's in here with you. Someone's in here with you, Carol!"
Carol had never felt another person in the darkness. Not a moment's contact with Hattie ever translated into the coma itself. Even as Dwight and Farah carried her body upstairs, Carol felt nothing. But now, fingertips. A palm, a hand rolling her over.
Roll over.
Carol felt herself rolling, rolling onto her back.
Roll over.
Was she doing this? Was she responsible for the roll?
No.
And the two letters, thought by her, exploded across the everywhere sky of Howelltown. Rolling now, rolling, she heard shuffling, feet upon stone. Rats, she told herself. Because if it wasn't rats, then how about that? She was sideways now, yes. There was no question she had rolled.
"Been rolled, Carol. Been rolled. Someone did this. Someone, not you."
To her side, a woman falling through black tar infinity on her side, her dress no doubt flapping in a different way, her hair now wholly off to one side, as though pulled. Still rolling. Rolling over. Until Carol felt the momentum of her roll, felt herself moving quicker, unable to influence the speed of the spin at all.
"You're going to keep rolling, spinning, twirling into nothingness. Can't stop forever. Can't stop forever. Can't..."
She stopped. The roll was complete. And for the first time ever in her life, Carol Evers was on her back in Howelltown. She looked up and saw all the darkness she'd fallen through. She heard the horse wheezing. She recalled the cold hand. And just as she attempted to shove these frightening aspects from her mind, Carol saw. Carol saw. Light. And the anxiety she'd felt at discovering her husband's betrayal was laughable compared with the sensation of sight in the coma. She was no longer falling, and yet not awake. She lay on her back on a stone slab in a storm room she could see, a storm room she had assisted in building herself. And the light. It appeared to be a sconce, yes, one of the candles aflame upon the left stone wall. And at the very distant arc of the candle's range, she saw, the open dark space of the storm room entrance. Carol could hardly comprehend the sight of it. It was the storm room, yes, not in a dream, not in her mind's eye, and whoever had helped her onto her back had also given her this light. Right? Near 50 times now, she had climbed the wood ladder with her mother and called Hattie's name as she fell through the earth's crust, to the inner core where, only Carol knew, there was no heat, no fire, no light. She was not awake. Yet, what had become of Howelltown? "You've reached the end," she thought. And with this thought came an even deeper plunging of fear. For what could be considered the finish of a place with no lines? But Carol knew this was no end. Whoever had rolled her over was only beginning. She heard the shuffling of bare skin on the pebbled floor. This, Carol now recognized, was not the patter of rodent feet within a dusty cellar.
"John?"
Her voice. Her lips had moved. Movement and light. The shock of it was so great that she hardly had time to reprimand herself for calling her friend's name. Wherever she was, this was no place John Bowie would be, in life or death. For while it looked like the storm room and smelled like her cellar in Harrow's, Carol was very aware that, light or no light, she was still deep in the darkness. She stared at the entrance to the storm room because she couldn't bring herself to look anywhere else. She held her breath, the sour air growing even more stale within her. She steeled herself for the sight of whoever had rolled her over. The candle flickered, but no wind came, and Carol heard the horse breathing more clearly than she ever had before. A face peered in at the storeroom door. It was not Dwight, not Hattie in death, nor John. The face looked painted, or as if several faces had been painted upon the same flat canvas, stored so deep in the shadows that Carol couldn't see its frame. Carol expelled the sour air with a cry for help. This fear was deeper than any grave. She heard a baying from far away, echoes off a stone passage. Madly, she imagined she was buried, but buried beneath the graves of the graveyard. Even ghouls did not dig this deep. The howl she had heard did not resemble lament, but celebration, as if the creature who cried did not scratch its coffin lid, but rather the wood beneath, until the splinters might give way to dirt, and the dirt give way to Carol.
Carol.
It was the watcher who spoke, the one peering in the doorway like a voyeur, the head whose many faces she could see.
Carol, Carol, Carol.
The lines of its face were fluid, one painted face becoming another. Its mouth did not move. Despite knowing she couldn't, Carol tried to move. The watcher entered, and Carol saw its mouth was a blur, its nose too small for its eyes, its skin a shade of horse urine. Then his features changed entirely, occupying only the top right corner of his face, before flowing like blood back down to their proper positions.
"I've watched you,"
it said, as though what it spoke of could somehow be considered sane. It pressed its back to the wall, sliding away from Carol now, deeper into the storm room.
"I've watched you fall for a long time now."
Sliding along the wall, its chin drooped like candle wax to its chest.
"Do you hear that?"
it said.
"This is the sound of rot's approach, Carol. The rot that follows death, deserved or not."
A second face sprang from the blackness to Carol's right. Its skin stretched back to from where it came, breath as foul as a mole's den. Once again, despite knowing she couldn't, Carol tried to move. The face beside her broke into clumps of dirt. The pieces fell to the storeroom floor.
"That," Rot said. Still coming, sliding against the right wall now, advancing parallel to the length of her still body, "is something you'll have to get used to. You will not be waking this time."
Suddenly it was beside her, its face a finger length from her own. Its breathing was the hoarse music of Howelltown.
"You've heard tales of babes left to starve in the brush, men strung up by their toes, hearts removed and hearts never found, but there are worse things on the trail than outlaws." Carol closed her eyes, but the world, her world, went dark for only a breath. As her eyes still closed, the dimensions of the cellar returned, lit anew by the same candle in its sconce, coming to life. The man peered once again from across the storeroom, wild eyes in the entrance, watching her on the slab. But his voice continued beside her. "Rot, Carol, rot." She opened her eyes and saw he was still against the wall, still coming. He wore a childish smile, his lips blurred, and Carol was afraid to close her eyes again, to open them, to close them, to "sleep, Carol," he said, fingering the wall, and his fingertips sounded like the pattering of rats. "You do not want to be awake for all that comes your way." Carol watched as he became the cracks in the stone walls, as the candlelight flickered, but did not dissolve. Then it was gone. Carol heard her mother hammering, heard James Moxie crying out that she was dead, heard Dwight, too, whimpering in the shadows of this impossible cellar. She closed her eyes, and this time did find darkness. But when she opened them again, the room was still lit, as if her visitor wanted her to see all that was coming her way. She heard, too, the cries of those in their graves who did not desire to dig up, but rather down, burrowing deeper to where Carol lay, to where they could already smell the possibility of rot, reaching for a woman who would soon be buried alive, and whose rot was ordained, was assured, was coming. Then the wind returned, and Carol didn't know which way she fell. But up or down, down or up, the light remained, and through the rippling storeroom walls, through the flickering flame, she saw all the nightmares of her youth, life in Howltown, coming. And yet there was hope, for Carol had learned that both monsters and madmen make mistakes. Dwight had overlooked her former lover, a man on the trail who knew of her condition. And the thing that just left her, that had killed the electricity in her veins, leaving her in the cold, empty country beyond anxiety and fear, that thing had made a mistake of its own. For all he had wanted to frighten her, and for all he had, he'd also changed her lot. He'd rolled her over. And Carol, never having been on her back before in the coma, discovered immediately, alone, that things were different now. She moved. It was slight, hardly anything at all, but movement all the same. Using every pound of inner strength she possessed, Carol lifted her chin toward her chest, then allowed her head to travel the quarter inch back down to the stone slab. It was a start, an astonishing one, and it gave her the strength to try again. And again, until, as the sun rose outside Harrow's, a sun that did not penetrate the storeroom, Carol could conceive of actually sitting up, of actually rising, of actually taking action in Howltown.
Morning. Moxie opened his eyes to see the mare walking, unhitched, about the ashes of the fire. He woke to the sound of wood crushed to dust beneath a hoof. Someone had unhitched her overnight, and yet she had not left him. Moxie rose. Probably it was the horror from Portsooth, the face he'd seen through the fire, floating above the dirt. But maybe not. Moxie put his hat on and quickly hitched the mare. Then, pausing to think, he unhitched her again. He brought his face close to hers. "Thank you, old girl." Leaving her free, he rolled the bedding. He got water from the pouch and let the mare drink. She lapped it up readily, and Moxie wondered if in some way the unnatural fire, the occurrences of the night before, had added to her thirst. Had the mare taken off, curious or otherwise, Moxie would have had little chance of making it to Harrow's. The telegram from Ferradero told him that Carol's funeral was set for tomorrow morning. Moxie had made it half the trail in one day. If he could maintain this pace, he could get there in time. And yet, whoever hired the trigger man, the man Rinaldo spoke of, whoever wanted Moxie dead, no doubt wanted Carol dead too. Perhaps that's who unhitched the horse. Perhaps not. And then there was the horror from Portsooth. Rot.
Moxie understood clearly that in the state Carol was in, it would only take a modicum of pressure on a pillow to kill her. Pinching her nostrils would do the trick. Why hadn't whoever hired the trigger man done so already? And who was to say he hadn't? Moxie fed the mare. He looked up to the sky. The sun was not visible, though something of it showed. A thin purple beam washed across the landscape, the treetops, the ashes of the fire, the extra boot prints still present in the dirt. "Are you good now, old girl?" He patted the mare on the muzzle and put the feed away. He remembered Carol telling the second doctor she was conscious of what was going on while inside the coma, but that voices were strange, familiar, but changed. This meant she was most likely somewhat conscious now. Moxie mounted the mare. Again, he imagined Carol plucking one breath after another from a jar. At some point, she'd run out. The outlaw looked down to the ashes of the fire. "I am rot." A wave of steady rage flowed through him. He closed his eyes, and the purple morning passed over the stoic features of his face. "Let's go, old girl." On the trail again, the very top of the sun showing now, the mare rested, moved with strength, and with the will and haste of her master. Smoke brought a hand to his nose as he limped through the lobby. The place smelled like pig shit. Whiskey, beef, beer, and sex. Men snored on worn couches, their heads on the armrests, their mouths slack, open like torn water pouches. The smell of the morning ghosts of the tramps assaulted him. A dozen stale perfumes jostling for air. The scents left behind of the beasts who wore them. Smoke limped. Beneath his boots he saw the carpet was stained, fresh blots of spilled drinks and piss. The place was a kennel. All pissing hog's hell for territory, and mounting each other for sport. By the front door, on the floor, he spotted a half-eaten, waterlogged piece of bread. He pinched it between his fingers, limped back to one of the sleeping men, and dropped it into his open mouth. Then he grabbed a stool from the bar and limped out of the cat house. Outside, Smoke counted three horses tied to posts beside his own. He untied the strongest and set the stool beside it. Gripping his thigh, he swung his right leg over its back and pulled himself up by the mane. Some oil spilled out between the rags and spotted the chestnut back of the animal. The beast felt strong beneath his weak and warped legs. Goodbye to the castrated gelding. This horse was a stallion. "Wherever you were headed before," Smoke told the animal, "we're going north now." He pulled the reins, and the horse responded. Pulling away from the post, Smoke looked to the dirt and saw a set of fast, fresh tracks crossing town. Someone in a hurry this morning, before Smoke woke. Smoke studied the tracks. It wasn't the outlaw. Moxie was ahead of him. Of this, Smoke was sure. So who? "A lot of pig shit travels the trail," he half sang. "From hell's heaven to heaven's hell." He smacked the stallion on the side of its strong body. He dismissed the fresh tracks and focused instead on an impossible legend. A man duel, triumphant without drawing his gun. "Oh, he's an outlaw!" Smoke sang in full, his voice growing stronger under the purple band of dawn. "And he knows how to hide." The horse crossed the town's northern border. "Oh, he's an outlaw," Smoke bellowed to the empty trail ahead. "But today's his last ride. Oh, today's his last ride." The horse neighed. "You like that, horse fella? Oh, but you do. You must. Today's his last ride." Dwight took hold of the gun beneath his pillow and sat up in bed. There was a man in his bedroom. "Wake," the stranger said. Dwight fired once into the corner, but the shape remained. Dwight fired again. A hole exploded in the plaster, and the shape remained. "Did the outlaw kill me last night?" Dwight cried. The stranger moved slightly, and Dwight saw one face morph into another.
Who are you?
Dwight asked.
You need to hide your lady. His voice was skin peeling. His voice was breaking bones.
What do you know about my lady? My lady is dead.
The stranger's face spread wide on the bones of its face before dissolving into the shadows behind it.
You need to hide your lady now.
When Dwight responded, his voice shook along with his hands.
You need to leave my business to me. My lady is dead. Leave now, whoever you are, or I'll shoot again.
The stranger stepped away from the wall, closer to the bed.
Was this James Moxie, then? Was this the end? People are coming for you,
the stranger said. A new face, a new mouth.
They've already set out for your home.
People? What people? I've nothing to hide. My lady is...
The shape came closer. Dwight recoiled, blinked, and when he opened his eyes again, the form was sliding along the contours of the wall, changing with the shape of the vanity as it passed into the unlit hall beyond. Dwight leapt from bed. He shouted to the open door.
I will not hide anything! I will not hide her! You know nothing of my lady! You know nothing of me!
But he was fearful the stranger did. Unsure what to do first, where to go, who to trust, Dwight stood motionless in the center of the bedroom. Then he rushed to the window. He saw nobody, heard no more.
You've got to hide your lady. People are coming for you. They've already set out for your home.
Sleep still in his eyes, Dwight looked long at the bedroom doorway. Then he moved quickly toward the hall, the first floor, the cellar, and the first place he could think to hide her.
"It's most likely nothing, Cole,"
Opal said, leaning back in his chair.
"But you think it might be?"
"Enough to ask you to come with me, sure."
The deputy rubbed his red eyes.
"Mr. Evers, though? And Carol Evers? I just never would have guessed anything foul going on."
"And don't guess it now. We don't know a thing. All we got is the idea of a mortician who might be hot he didn't get the job to dress her."
Cole nodded.
"Sheesh, Opal. That would be an ugly reason to go tattling."
"Have you seen uglier?"
"I suppose I have."
"Yes, you have."
Opal rose now and glanced through the blinds of the window. But for a purpling sky, it was still dark yet. Hardly a person could be seen on the street.
"When are we going to head out?"
Cole asked, scratching his head.
"We're going to go right now."
Cole nodded. He'd figured as much.
"Let me get my things, Sheriff."
As Cole vanished, Opal looked to Deputy Kern, seated across the station at Opal's wooden desk.
"We shouldn't be gone long."
"Sheriff, you really think Mr. Evers might have done something?"
Kern asked.
"I don't think anything. And you and Deputy Cole better stop thinking I'm thinking something just because I'm thinking out loud."
"Sure will, Sheriff."
Opal stepped to his desk, picked up a plate of steak and eggs, and shoveled some of it into his mouth. He held the plate out to Kern.
"You eat yet?"
No, Sheriff, I haven't."
"You want the rest of these?"
No, thank you, Sheriff, I surely don't."
"Well, you better eat something. I don't want to come back in a few hours and find you're off getting fed somewhere."
"I'll be here, Sheriff. You can count on that."
"I can't count on anything, Kern."
Cole came back into the room wearing a coat, his gun at his hip.
"I'm ready when you say, Sheriff."
The deputy followed Opal out the door. The men mounted their horses and started toward the Evers home.
"It's about half an hour's ride," Opal said. "And if you feel like talking any, try talking about something nice. I don't want my mind all cluttered with your worrying and asking questions."
"Sure thing, Sheriff. How about Marcy Reynolds? You hear she had her baby?"
"I sure did,"
Opal answered, squinting into the purple and orange sunrise at the end of the road.
"And that's nice. A little baby Lucy. 7 pounds, I heard. A good, healthy baby. That's nice."
Dwight visits Lafayette again. The two stood in the alley behind the tavern. The alley smelled of garbage.
The sun was up, and Dwight removed his coat, draping it over one arm. The day was far too warm, he felt, suffocating. He couldn't shake the nightmare image of the stranger in the corner of his bedroom. A ghoul, perhaps. A crazed man. Way Dwight saw it, nobody's ghost stories ought to be trusted when experienced upon waking. Whatever he saw, it couldn't have been as bad as he thought it was. Damn, Manders. If only Carol was already buried, there'd be no better place to hide her. All this madcap anxiety would be behind him. His worrying about what Faradero knew, and now what this stranger knew, all of it would be put to rest, beneath him, buried. Instead, today Carol could wake. Tonight she could wake. Right now, as he spoke with Lafayette, Carol could rise and walk straight to Sheriff Opal's station armed with everything she'd heard in the coma. Dwight wasn't even sure what he'd said in her presence and what he hadn't. Damn, Manders. Shouldn't a man, a grieving man, be permitted to bury his wife where and when he deemed fit? Hell's heaven! Carol was dead! But the stranger who woke him knew she wasn't. Someone knows. Someone knows. Someone knows. Dwight needed to put out the fire in his blood.
It's a bad thing to get nervous in this business, Evers.
I don't like not knowing is what it is, Dwight said. Lafayette eyeballed him. Her hair hung loose about her face, no longer in a ponytail, and Dwight thought she appeared unhinged. He wondered if everything looked unhinged to a frightened man.
You can hire as many people as you like, Evers. You can hire everybody, but then everybody knows.
A bluebird settled on a chicken wire garbage box. It made a belching sound, as though it had just eaten.
You don't expect me to believe that the men you work with are part of everybody, do you?
These men know people, Evers. They talk.
Lafayette, Dwight whispered. I need to know Moxie is dead.
You hired a professional. You should act the same. Wait.
I want to hire someone for smoke.
It's just not smart thinking, Evers.
Can you do it?
Of course I can do it, but I'm in on this deal, and I don't like this.
A second bluebird landed on the wire box. Lafayette said,
The cripple will be back before your second man has time to leave. My advice is you go home. You keep crawling into the daylight like this, hiring more men, and presto, people you don't want around will be knocking on your door. People you thought you had nothing to do with.
What does that mean?
What do you think it means?
Dwight looked over his shoulder, to the mouth of the alley. The birds looked nervous, he thought. Hide your lady.
I need to know Moxie's dead.
Just tell me what you want to do.
I want you to get someone to watch the cripple.
Lafayette exhaled.
I'll tell you what I think you should do, and then you tell me what you want me to do. I think you should go home and grieve. I think you should go home and make sure things are set right with the funeral, and grieve with friends and family and forget about the outlaw and the cripple. I think you should bury your wife like any good man would, and I think you should wait. Moxie makes it here safe, then we can talk about hiring someone else. You don't understand the character you're paying. He might have finished the job and done another for no money at all. Or he could be at the gates of Harrow's now, the blood of your outlaw, on his hands as proof. You send someone else out, and you'll upset the man. You don't want that loose bird landing on your shoulder. Men like this don't like to be babysat. You send someone. He'll know it. And when he comes back to let you know the job is done, he might do one more for himself.
Don't threaten me, Lafayette.
This is no threat, Evers. This is the trail.
A third bird settled on the wire box and nipped at the first two. Dwight yelled,
Pig shit birds!
Lafayette laughed. Dwight said, I want someone to follow smoke. Lafayette nodded.
Consider it done.
Who do you have in mind?
I've got a man.
Who is it?
I've got a man, Evers. He'll check on him. He'll report back. What more do you need me to tell you?
Chilled now, Dwight slipped his coat back on. Lafayette said,
"Just remember I warned you. Remember I said Smoke won't like it."
"I don't care what the freak likes. He works for me." Then Dwight knelt and picked up a stone and threw it at the birds. But he missed badly, and the bluebirds only watched it clip the alley's brick wall before falling to the dirt. They continued pecking at the wire. Dwight surely expected Lafayette to say something, nice aim, that implied he was misfiring and making bad choices, but when he turned around to face the trail watcher, he only saw Lafayette's unkempt hair slipping out of view, out the mouth of the alley.
"Good," Dwight said, as if Lafayette's absence somehow validated his decision after all.
The wheels were in motion now. Someone would watch Smoke, and Smoke would catch Moxie, and Moxie would die. A simple chain, Dwight thought, easy pieces, one after the other.
"Moxie will die," he said, stepping from the alley.
He paused for a woman, and the woman looked at him as if maybe she'd heard what he just said. He watched her walk away, imagining his own deeds formulating in her head, as if, just by seeing him, she'd been able to determine all he had in mind. She looked nervous to Dwight. Hell's heaven, the whole world was nervous. But not Lafayette. Lafayette had predicted Dwight would want someone to watch Smoke. Let Dwight think he was calling the shots. Let him believe he was born again. Either way, Lafayette wasn't going to hire someone as crazed as Smoke to follow Smoke. No. In fact, she had already sent word down the pipe. The trail, the unseen channel of communication that Lafayette knew as well as witches knew the contents of their brews. She'd hired someone, yes. But rather than hire another man who might need to be watched, she'd sent for the man who does the watching. Moxie at the Hermit House. Moxie hadn't seen his longtime riding partner in 9 years, but knew that didn't matter. Jefferson was just about as stuck in time as nobody deserved to be, and Moxie wouldn't be surprised if he hadn't noticed any time pass at all. The horse was tired. She had endurance, but she was old. Hadn't been ridden this much over 2 days since before Moxie settled. It was hard terrain, and more than one tricky incline brought the beast to gasping. At times Moxie thought little of it, a sacrifice, let the horse die if she must. But the horse had done well by him, and the brief stop at Jefferson's would do them both some good. In truth, Moxie needed to pick something up. Rinaldo's news was worrisome. Moxie didn't know of any crippled trigger man. The guy could be good. Some hitmen were. It had been a long time since Moxie knew the names of the trail.
"We're gonna take a break here, old girl."
He led the horse onto a path overgrown with ferns and moss-coated logs. Off the trail, the dirt was more like clay, and the horse stopped. Moxie patted her hide gently, encouraging, and the pair set across it. The beast's hooves crushed black leaves and snapped dead branches. The sun came through fractured, unwelcome in this dying landscape. He could see Jefferson's home, a brick rectangle between the withered trees. An old one-room schoolhouse Jefferson found soon after the pair stopped riding together. Moxie could use some help. The sight of Jefferson's home was a good one. He guided the mare through a yard covered in junk. Barrels, wagon parts, broken chairs stuck into the earth. Bales of hay, too. Beside a moss-grown cabinet, he dismounted and looped the horse to an old hitching post, half-covered in mushrooms, once used by the teachers. Above the house, he saw the blackened top of a chimney, soot that reached down the length of brick like black oil oozing. Someone was moving inside. Moxie saw the shape of a man behind a blanket covering a cracked window. The place, the setting, felt funereal. Moxie thought of holes in the earth. The trees surrounding the home were dying. The grass was yellowed. Dishes were piled on the front stone step. And the shape within did not move well. A cripple, Moxie thought. Cautiously, his eyes on the window, he removed the gun from his right holster. Rinaldo's warning burned hot. Was the trigger man ahead of him? Here? He cocked the gun. The shape within crossed the breadth of the window and stopped. The thin blanket was pulled aside, and Moxie saw the face of his old friend, and he exhaled, lowering his gun. It had been a long time since Moxie had experienced that type of rush, but the sight of his friend trumped the rising nostalgia. Jefferson had taken a turn for the worse. The door opened, and Jefferson came out hunched forward. One hand was on his lower back, the other already extended to shake Moxie's. "Hello, friend," Moxie said, smiling for the first time since the telegram told him Carol would be buried.
"Jimmy, Jimmy, I tell you, it's been too long, boy, too long. Why, it's been a decade or more."
"Almost," Moxie said. They embraced. Jefferson's back was in bad shape. He could hardly stand. His clothes were ragged, and he smelled of sweat and urine. He smelled of meat, too.
"You been cooking?" Moxie asked.
"Oh, yes, I have, Jimmy. You want some?"
Moxie considered.
"I do, Jefferson. Come on over and meet my horse."
Jefferson leaned farther forward, one hand craned to his back, and followed Moxie to the looped mare.
"That's a good horse, Jimmy. She sure is."
"I know it, Jefferson. Rode all the way from Mackatoon yestermorn."
"Shudders, Jimmy. Mackatoon yesterday?"
"Gotta be in Harrow's by nightfall."
"You'll make it. You'll make it."
Jefferson stroked the mare's neck.
"What's your name, Jimmy?"
Moxie gave the horse water and considered.
"Never named my horses, Jefferson. I think old girl will do."
Jefferson's face lit up. Moxie liked to see that.
"Old girl is a fine name, Jimmy, just fine. Let's get her fed."
Moxie made to help him, but Jefferson stepped to an open bale with a pitchfork beside it and brought some hay to the horse. A goat watched before walking deeper into the tall weeds of the yard.
"There you go, old girl,"
Jefferson said, wincing. Then Jefferson asked Moxie if he'd like to see his place. Moxie said of course he would. Moxie untied the green sack from the saddle, and they crossed the yard and entered the schoolhouse. The first word Moxie thought upon entering, before the words filth or disarray, was books. The schoolhouse was stuffed with them. Stacks of books from floor to mid-wall, shelves too high for Moxie to read the spines, certainly too high for Jefferson to get to now. Loose pages covered the floor like carpet and crunched beneath his dirty boots. Tabletops barely supported the weight of biblio-pyramids, towers from countertop to stone ceiling. Still, nothing matched the spectacle on the walls. Handwritten words covered the bricks, grease marks from a greasy hand. Words everywhere, some bigger than others, titles, chapter titles, footnotes, some sloping at the corners, finding room. Moxie bent to read a passage.
"Are these your words?" he asked.
Jefferson nodded.
"That's right, they are, Jimmy. Been writing my own book."
On the walls, Moxie thought. Moxie smiled again, but Jefferson did not look good. For Moxie, this was hard to see, and yet the help he needed from Jefferson was not in the form of Jefferson's person. There was no separation of rooms in the house. It was one long rectangle where once a teacher lectured. A well-dressed, small trail-towner, Moxie imagined. A man or woman certainly no better read than Jefferson. A child's desk remained from those days, and Moxie saw that Jefferson still used it. Papers were piled upon it, some written by Jefferson, some torn from other books. Difficult, long words were carved into the wood of it, too. A map of Ukatanani and Miskaloosa counties hung from the wall, and string connected town to town on the trail. With his trigger finger, Moxie followed the string from Mackatoon to Harrow's. Looking around, he saw there was a lot of string. Stacks of books were held together with string, candles were secured to their sticks with it, coats hung from the string between bookshelves, balls of string stood precariously piled in the corners. String for the pictures, string for the tools. Enough of it to cocoon the schoolhouse twice over. Moxie sat in a small chair once used by a young student, set the green sack on a second chair beside him.
"You taking care of your back?"
he asked, his voice quiet in the padded house.
"I'm worried."
"You're worried? It's all I can think about."
Jefferson laughed and walked uneasily to a table.
"I like your red shirt, Jimmy. Makes you look young, like you stepped straight out of the past."
He paused. Moxie imagined he was recalling that past.
"Want that meat now, Jimmy?"
Moxie looked out through the cracked window and saw the mare was still eating.
Thank you, Moxie said. That'd be fine.
Jefferson scooped some beef onto a plate as Moxie eyed an old fish tank, now used to store more books. Through the glass he read titles he'd never heard of before. String held the covers closed.
You rob a library, Jefferson?
Jefferson came with two plates, handed one to Moxie, and had a hard time setting himself down on a rocker.
That's a dream of mine, you know, he said. Imagine all them bindings. Could make a bed of them.
I'm surprised you don't sleep on a bed of books as it stands.
Ha! Well, sometimes I do.
Jefferson struggled to lift his fork.
What leads you to Harrow's, Jimmy?
It was hard to reconcile the sight of Jefferson now with the lightning rod riding partner Moxie had discovered the trail with.
Going to break apart a funeral.
You don't say.
I do.
Moxie ate. Jefferson cackled, his half-toothless mouth a black hole of joy.
We've done some things, Jimmy. We have. But a funeral, that'd be a trail topper to be sure.
I brought you something, Moxie said, patting the sack beside him. Jefferson bunched his brow and looked down at it.
No presents, Jimmy. You being here is more than enough.
Take them, Moxie said.
I don't need them.
He knelt and removed a new pair of boots, a shirt he'd worn but once, gardening, a fresh pair of pants. Jefferson smiled.
Well, Jimmy, I could sure use me some clothes.
It feels good, Jefferson. It feels good to be riding again.
Jefferson's head bobbed slowly in the dull light.
I'd join you, but I got no horse. Sure as shutters, none as nice as yours.
But both knew Jefferson could ride no more. Moxie felt a longing for the past, the knights, the people, the legends.
I'd like that, Moxie said. Might have brought another had I known you'd come. Things are tricky out there.
How's that, Jimmy?
Might have some bad men on my tail.
You always have. We both have.
You're right, Jefferson. But it's been some time. I've been planting rose bushes for near a decade.
A trigger man?
Yes. And something else.
Jefferson's eyes clouded.
There are worse things than men on the trail, Jimmy.
A trail mantra. A phrase both had heard 1,000 times and more. A truth both saw for themselves.
Yes, there are.
Hurt you, don't it?
Riding?
Riding and not riding, too.
Yes, it does. Easter Eve, I slept about as sore as any man ever slept.
I believe you.
Jefferson cackled again, quieter. Now he was sitting up and pointing.
Jimmy, you remember the time we hid in that hole for all of 2 days? Shudder, Jimmy. We must have heard those men pass over us 12 times. They talked about where we were, theorized all the livelong day. We was right under them, Jimmy. Right there under them.
He fell back into his seat again and laughed, bringing his hands to his chest. Moxie smiled and looked to the window and saw the mare still eating.
You writing about those days? Moxie asked.
Some,
Jefferson said.
I'm writing about the burden of thinking hard on things for so many years.
Moxie nodded.
I'd read that book.
I'm writing about riding, too, 'cause I can't separate the two. Thinking and riding. Rides and thoughts.
Moxie looked up and saw more writing on the ceiling.
You hurt your back doing this?
That I did.
You thinking of taking a photo, Jefferson?
Sure I do. I met a man with a camera one time. Wouldn't mind stealing something like that.
Moxie smiled again.
Used to be we could take it while they watched.
Used to be!
The men laughed. Jefferson coughed. Then Moxie said,
I've got to get riding, Jefferson.
I expect you could use something from me, Jimmy.
I could,
Moxie said, glad Jefferson had brought it up.
Well, you done seen for yourself I got enough.
I did.
With difficulty, Jefferson got up and crossed the room. Moxie heard him rummaging behind a stack of leather-bound books.
You want something to drink, Jimmy?
I thank you, but no, Jefferson. On the return, I'll say yes.
Moxie rose. Jefferson handed him a yellow canvas bag.
You look good, Jimmy. Don't worry about who's tailing you. He's the one to worry.
Moxie nodded. Use the clothes I brought you, Jefferson. It's good to see you, old friend. Jefferson took his hand.
I'm just upset I ain't going with you.
Moxie saw longing in his friend's eyes, as if every bone in Jefferson's body was fiending for the trail. Then Jefferson walked Moxie to the door.
I'm going to take another look at your four-legger.
Outside on the front step, Moxie said,
Jefferson, if a crippled man comes through here, you don't need to be talking to him. Any man with a physical problem or anything like one. You got it?
Sure, Jimmy. I got it.
A one-armed man, a limping man, even a man with just one eye. Anybody like that comes knocking at your door, and I'd like to be sure you won't answer is what I'm asking.
Sure, Jimmy.
Moxie patted his good friend on the shoulder.
If the good old days were as good as we believe them to have been, then you should see me soon on the return. I'll bring you any books I find.
That'd be fine, Jimmy.
Well, thanks for the meat, Jefferson. Moxie crossed the lawn, gripping the bag Jefferson gave him. He tied it to where the green sack had been and unhitched the mare. In that moment, it was very clear to him how far Harrow's was, as if he could count the pebbles of dirt between himself and Carol, the length of the trail.
That's a good girl, Moxie said, patting the mare and mounting her.
That's a fine girl, all right, Jimmy. Old girl,
Jefferson called from the front step.
She's going to get you there by nightfall. No worries.
Moxie tipped his hat goodbye and turned the horse around. The pair were rested, fed, and ready for the remainder. Jefferson's brick schoolhouse behind him, Moxie knew there would be no more friends along the way. Just Carol at rest, and those who didn't want him to wake her. Opal at the Evers' home. The sheriff knocked twice before he tried the handle. The deputy made a noise like he was about to say something, but Opal looked at him, and he didn't. The door was locked, and so Opal knocked again. He called Dwight's name, and his voice boomed across the quiet yard. It was full morning now. The ride over had taken longer than Opal said it would, and the sun was up and showing. Cole looked to the sky and saw it above the house, and for a minute couldn't believe anything foul whatsoever could take place within such a home.
"I suppose we ought to go around back, then," Opal said.
Cole nodded, but didn't make to move, and the sheriff looked at him sternly, and Cole understood that he was the one who was supposed to go around back then. He left the sheriff standing at the door and took the stone steps Carol had put in herself across the grassy yard. Yellowed spots showed in the sunlight, and Cole thought them dead. Squirrels scurried up the big willow trees. He heard the sheriff call Evers' name again as he turned the corner of the house. There he saw the top of the gardens down the hill he was now ascending, and the stone path that must lead to the back door. He, too, called Evers' name, not wanting to chance upon the man relaxing, working, or worse, grieving.
Mr. Evers, it's Deputy Cole and Sheriff Opal. We're here to see you're doing all right.
There was no answer, and Cole wondered if the quiet was what Opal called the loaded kind.
Mr. Evers, Deputy Cole here.
He knocked on the back door and heard the empty echo follow. He thought of Opal trying the front door and knew that if he didn't try this one here, he would get a talking to when he came back around. He called out one last time and tried the handle and found it was locked and blew out a sigh of relief. He's not home. Cole stepped away from the door and then thought he hadn't tried hard enough. He thought of Opal saying as much. He turned and tried the handle again, and the door opened. Cole peered into the darkness.
Mr. Evers? Deputy Cole here. Sheriff Opal is out front. We've been trying to get your attention. Opal wants to talk to you some.
No answer came. No movement from within. Cole stepped in and closed the door behind him, but then opened it again to give him some light. He crossed the room and found himself in the family kitchen. It was strange, uninvited as he was, seeing dishes that weren't his, a glass on the counter, a bowl of something on the table. He took the hall to the front door, unlocked it, and found Opal still standing there.
"Just let yourself right in, did you?"
Cole raised his brows.
I thought that's what you wanted.
Opal stepped past him, already looking about the home.
It's cold in here, Cole. Am I right?
Sure is, Sheriff.
Opal took a cursory glance into the parlor, and then the dining room, too. Cole followed him as he stepped through the house, his boots clunking against the wood floors, stopping to examine things that interested him.
I suppose we better go downstairs, Opal said.
Sheriff?
Yes, Cole.
What do we do if she's down there?
What do? We give her a once-over and hope Dwight Evers can explain who Alexander Wolfe is.
Give her a once-over.
That's right.
For bruises and whatnot.
Opal was looking at the chandelier hanging in the foyer, but now he turned to his deputy.
That's right, Cole. We're looking for foul play, not their taste in drapes.
Cole nodded and followed Opal deeper into the house. The sheriff checked the office. He looked at some papers on the desk and thought, yes, he had seen something like fear in Manders's eyes. Fear in the eyes of a man who handled dead bodies all day. A man who oversaw the makeup applied to dead eyelids, dressing up the fleshy faces of bloated ladies who no longer breathed. Manders buried children. Jane Fleury was just 5 when she caught the cough that sent her down into the earth. And Doris Mickey's kid must have been something to look at after he fell from the roof of their house like he did. If there was a man in Harrow's who ought to be immune to the shudders of finality, it was Robert Manders.
Sheriff!
Cole was calling from the kitchen. Opal went to him.
This here's the door to the cellar.
Opal came into the kitchen and stuck his head in the frame. He took the candlestick from the wall and asked Cole if he had a match. The deputy lit it.
Well, Opal said, let's hope for the best.
What's the best?
Nothing, Opal said. Nothing is best.
Cole followed him down the creaking stairs. Once they reached the cellar floor, Opal didn't speak anymore, didn't call out to Evers, and Cole understood he shouldn't either. The sheriff stopped and brought the candle to the wall, checking some luggage he found there. The cases were empty, and Cole guessed he was looking to see if Dwight Evers had planned on going somewhere fast. Opal turned and trained the light on the doorway of a storm room. The more affluent citizens of Harrow's had these types of rooms in their basements. Shelter. Some citizens had numerous subterranean rooms. Opal had found some bad things in the cellars of Harrow's. His shoes scuffled the concrete floor as he stepped to the entrance and stopped. He held the candle far out before him.
Nothing, he whispered.
Cole leaned over his shoulder and saw the same nothing. A cold, empty room with a stone slab of a table. More morgue than anything else. Opal stepped farther into the room and brought the candle low, illuminating the ground on the other side of the slab. Whatever he was searching for, Cole was certain he hadn't found it. And yet there were some breaks in the dust on the slab. 2 spots for shoulder blades, perhaps. A clean circle made by the back of a head. Then Opal motioned for Cole to follow him out of the room, and the 2 walked the rest of the damp basement. At the far end were some crates filled with traditional home items. Books, papers, tools. Opal turned to Cole.
Where is she, then?
He was talking now, not whispering, and his voice echoed off the stone.
Getting made up, Sheriff?
Opal nodded, wondered if he should have come last night.
Sounds about right.
The sheriff waited another moment, studying the dimensions the light gave him, and then crossed back to the stairs. In the kitchen again, Opal told Cole they ought to check out the bedrooms. Cole followed him up the stairs, the dark wood creaking. The sheriff tried the first door and decided it looked like the master bedroom. He walked the dimensions of the room once, stopped to look out through the drapes, then paused at a series of gunshots in the plaster wall.
Well, well.
No blood,
Cole said, squatting beside the sheriff. It wasn't uncommon to find bullet holes in even the finest homes in Harrow's. The lawman checked all 4 rooms upstairs.
"She's not here," Cole said.
"No, she's not."
They returned to the first floor. They locked the front door from the inside and went out the back. Cole asked him,
"You think anything untoward is going on, Sheriff?"
"I want to say there isn't, Cole, but I just don't know."
Manders came to mind again.
Manders, who had shaken the rubber hand of every person to die in Harrow's for 2 decades running. The local authority, death desensitized. It ought to take a monster to rattle Robert Manders. But Dwight Evers?
Let's get back,